Welcome to ESEIB's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I'm going to talk to Johan Norberg. Johan is a writer and broadcaster. He's one of the leading advocates in the world of globalization and an open world order. He has authored many books on current affairs, economics, and science, among them In Defense of Global Capitalism and, most recently, Progress, 10 Reasons to Look Forward to the Future. His television documentaries have been broadcasted by Channel 4 in Britain and PBS in America. Today, I'm going to talk to Johan about globalization, inequality, and the state of the world. Welcome to the podcast, Johan.
Thank you very much.
There is one thing that has been annoying me for some time and that I wanted to talk to you about, and it is this pretty sudden shift in the learned opinion about trade openness and globalization. At least I sometimes get the feeling that everyone now, the IMF, the World Bank, the OECD, famous economists around the world, are on this global apology tour, gallantly offering regret and remorse for the previous advocacy of trade openness and economic liberalism. The standard line now seems to be that globalization caused all the political problems we have seen lately, like the election win for Donald Trump, the Brexit referendum, the growth of populist parties around Western Europe. Free market policies are now accused of causing widespread inequality in the Western world, and supporters of these policies are supposed to amend for their naivety in allowing China and other authoritarian regimes to grow powerful. The strange thing, I think, is that many previous friends of liberalism buy all that, and that they buy much of the evidence behind those claims, and that they don't point to what I would say is the whole absurdity of the whole situation, which is that there is really nothing to regret here. What would it be? Would it be something like, I apologize for having supported a policy that has raised the welfare of rich Westerners and made their lives so much more interesting and rewarding, while people in poor parts of the world have managed to grow their incomes at a remarkable speed and reduced all the brutality of life that is associated with poverty? So, Johan, what is it that has happened, and what has turned the tide against global economic openness?
I think this is an excellent summary of the weird situation that we are in right now. And in a way, I don't think it's strange that we face backlashes against globalization and trade openness. We've seen that again and again throughout history, partly for the simple reason that even though open trade is overwhelmingly a positive benefit in people's lives, and we do always see some problems related to creative destruction. There is some dislocation, old industries, old jobs have to go. And again throughout history, from biblical times till the Luddites during the Industrial Revolution, there is always pressure against this. It might come from elites who feel that social mobility and foreigners disturbs their power, or it is from a particular group that is losing out for the moment, who then associate the elites with foreigners somehow disturbing the peace. So it's not strange, but what we also learn from history is that whether they succeed or not depends on how the others react, those who understand the benefits of trade openness and economic liberalization. In the eras when they fought on and continue to persistently explain the benefits of openness, then history has continued in a way. Whereas when they have gone on this apology tour, when they've given up, when they've said, oh, I'm so sorry for having promoted these ideas, that's the moment when we've lost out historically. So in a way, I think we're in a very dangerous situation right now, when so many who I think understand the benefits perfectly of globalization suddenly are giving the game away to those who object and will always object.
Do you think there is a pattern in history here? I mean, not just sort of long history, but more recent history. I'm thinking about perhaps a few examples over the past 50, 60 years when we've had economic crises in the world, slowdowns in the economy, oil crisis and all that. These have been periods when people more easily have been falling for, if not populist, so very simplistic messages about the economy, about society, about openness. What are the lessons learned from these occasions in more modern history? How did we get past them, and who were the ones who were helping us in order to restore almost faith in the broader principles of an open society?
Yes, I think there are many lessons to be learned about how generally economic periods of economic downturns and recessions generally lead to more of a belief that the economy is a zero-sum game. For fairly obvious reasons, it's counterintuitive that wealth is growing. It's difficult to understand, but when you see it all around you and when times are good, then you understand that, yes, you can benefit and so can other groups in society, so can neighboring countries as well. But in times of downturns, economic recessions, you see that the pie is shrinking or at least not growing as fast as it used to. Then it's more tempting to fall for the myth that the economy is a zero-sum game. And then for often trade is a traditional scapegoat. This trade and foreigners and rich people generally are associated with these problems, no matter where, how connected or how little the connection there is. I'm thinking of how we now, because we have suddenly are losing faith in open markets, we're suddenly beginning to blame it for all the problems that we've seen. We're talking about the Rust Belt in the US Midwest and Great Lakes region, suddenly as the decline of the Rust Belt is, and deindustrialization over there is something that we should blame globalization and free trade for, which is astonishing since the Rust Belt started to decline in the 1950s and 1960s, and more of a result of complacency and of a monopoly situation over there. They didn't restructure. They lost more jobs between the 1950s and 1980 in this region than afterwards, before they had any real competition from other countries, and this was more because of their lack of adapting to new technologies and very aggressive trade unions and incompetent management, which resulted in jobs leaving the Rust Belt and going to other American states that were more competitive. It's a very long-term phenomenon. I have to look into the complexity of the whole issue, but suddenly this is now read as a result of Chinese competition, of NAFTA or something like that. And it goes to show how trade is always the scapegoat whenever problems hit. Well, what happened before? How did we restore faith in trade back then? Well, problematically, one of the reasons is that we used to do that for often because of geopolitical demands and needs that forced Western countries and the US specifically to sort of be the spearhead of opening up the world, creating more international partnerships and cooperation, because the alternative would be a lack of the kind of development and international partners that would help the Eastern bloc, the communist bloc back then. So in some ways, I think there's a risk that this lack of awareness of the importance of international cooperation, there's a risk that we see that free trade is a collateral damage, basically, because that whole, those needs forced people to focus minds, basically, and we don't have that now.
So we basically need a new Soviet Union, right?
go that far.
Perhaps that's what we also are getting. I don't mean in the sense of a new empire growing in that part of the world, but when you these days listen to the perceptions, especially about China and China taking advantage of America or stealing jobs in Europe, there is a growing trend right now where there is much more of a confrontational and shrill rhetoric in the Western world vis-a-vis China, which I think, at least to some degree, amount to that geopolitical broader sort of support that was needed perhaps in the past in order to find reasons among politicians to basically support openness among some countries in the world. But I really wanted to go back to something you were saying before, and it's something I've also been wondering a bit about now, listening to the broad discussions that we have about populism, Trump, Brexit, and all that. So we have one argument out there which basically contends that this is highly related to the financial crisis in 2008-2009, that people have lost jobs. It's populism that's grown on the back of increasing economic insecurity. And I wonder how much to make of that argument. I think it's partly an issue about contrasting it with some of the other explanations that are out there. We have people like Eric Kaufman, Matthew Goodwin, and Roger Eatwealth that have written books which suggest that populism, both in America and Europe, tends to be more related to culture and identity rather than to economics. But I wonder, sort of, these are sort of the two main explanatory or two main explanations out there, but I wonder if it's perhaps a third one, which is more interesting, which you were alluding to, which is that we are talking about a broad economic development that have gone on over many, many decades. Nothing sudden, nothing that came with the financial crisis in 2008-2009, but that we've had economies and regions in societies that have grown complacent and where the opportunities for people to actually succeed in life, whether that's having economic success or having social success, have gradually led them to be more angry about society. So perhaps not writing off entirely the economics explanation behind populism. What do you say?
Yes, I think there is a third way in trying to understand these things, which is a combination of economic and cultural factors in a way, because I don't buy into the economic argument that this is generally just sort of a wage stagnation and a job loss story, because it doesn't really fit the voting patterns. And I also really don't buy the whole wage stagnation things aspect of it, which makes too much of the fact that we're only looking at, say, hourly wages and things like that, despite the fact that more and more of the compensation comes from non-wage benefits. In the US, we've seen a dramatic increase in the share of the wage that comes in the form of retirement pensions, in health insurance, life insurance, paid vacation, and so on. And if you include that, then, well, the hourly wage has not increased just 5% since 1970, but something like 60% for the workers. So, and when you look at where people are voting for Trump and similar politicians, it doesn't really fit this perfect description. But obviously, if you feel like because of restructuring, because of losses of particular industries and labor communities and identities, if you feel like these things combined makes you believe less in your society, in your community, and specifically in your political and economic leaders, that will obviously make you more interested in another kind of message about the way forward, or at least more interested in just sort of showing your visible disagreement and sock it to the elites in a way. So this is constantly ongoing, and specifically then in areas like the US Rust Belt, where we've seen this complacency, where with hopeless companies that haven't been able to adapt to the new world, then obviously you will feel like you're left out of that world, even if you might happen to have individually a job that's fairly decent or wage that's fairly okay. You will feel left behind. Now, if you add to this this general, I would almost say, nostalgia that's also universal. We all, when we reach the Middle Ages, begin to think that the best music was written 30 years ago, and the best movies and the best communities and the best cafes, and everything since then is sort of just awkward or even scary. Then that's always there. If you combine this with seeing other areas rapidly and changing, improving, making progress, you don't, then I think that this will also create this kind of a cultural resentment. And, cultural, psychological historians who look at this tend to say that nostalgia comes in waves of something like 30, 40 years ago. That's the golden era for every generation. Well, I don't think it's a coincidence that we now have the baby boom generation retiring. And obviously, looking back at their old 1950s and 1960s as the ideal world, in a way, an almost mythological past, even though that in a way was the era when we began to create hopeless difficulties in the economic sector, in manufacturing and so on in Western countries. I think we have to add that to our description of the world as well.
I think that's right. And I have this thinking for myself, which is that I'm going to blame my parents, the baby boomer generation, for all the faults we're seeing in society these days. Then I think to myself again, so what did that generation actually go through? Well, they had the music revolution, the alcohol revolution, the religious revolution. I mean, they rebelled basically about everything in society and wanted to turn it upside down. How can we sort of fit that history together with the fact that it's the baby boomer generation that tend now to vote for more authoritarian leaning type of candidates or political parties, and that they now seem to want to just have a quiet life? They don't want to have any rebellious actions at all.
Yeah, this seems very much like a paradox, but I'm not sure it is. In a way, this is a natural transition for every generation. Waking up and finding that everything's exciting and everything that stops you from exploring it is something that has to be done away with until you become the new sort of complacent elite, and then everything that disturbs it is problematic to you. I think it was Douglas Adams, the novelist of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and other books, he put it in another context when it comes to technology, that he had noticed some three different rules for how we look at the technologies of the day. And the first one was everything, and I'm probably getting the ages wrong, but never mind, somewhere around 15. So everything that's in the world before you're 15 years old is the natural state of the world. That's just the way things are. And then everything between 15 and 35 or something like that, that is pretty exciting, and you can probably get a career in it somehow, make a lot of money in it perhaps if you're lucky and work hard. And everything that comes into the world when it comes to technology then after you're 35 is against the natural order of things and has to be defeated. And I think you can see that again and again in the history of technology and the arts, how generations move through these cycles. And I think it's almost the same thing when it comes to how we look at the world, the economy, and at politics. There is something that's natural, and then there are some new innovators and disturbers of the peace who are very exciting and you want to join in to that. And that becomes your new world. But then afterwards, there are other innovators who are younger than you, do something else, and that's against the natural order of things, and that has to be defeated. So it's not strange that generations, as they grow older, become more reactionary in many ways. The problem is if we give them give that part of ourselves, because I think we all have a part of this within ourselves, give the benefit of the doubt and start to buy into that story that this is correct just because that happens to be the personal experience of of a lot of people, because that could really be selling the next generation short.
Yeah, no, very much so. So, Johan, I want to talk to you a little bit about your most recent book as well, Progress. But before coming there, I had one more thing I wanted to ask you about inequality, because you started to talk about inequality a little bit before, and you've done a lot of work throughout decades on broader developments on inequality. We quite often hear this story these days that globalization reduced inequality between countries, but raised inequality within countries. When you look at economists like Thomas Piketty and others, I think they've broadly alluded in that direction, if not supporting it straight away, but at least suggesting that there has been a long-term trend of growing inequality in Western societies, basically between capital and labor. Now, inequality analysis, of course, is notoriously complex and prone to ideological interpretation, but what are the key observations that you've made about the broad development of inequality in Western societies?
Well, yeah, when you ask about Western societies, then we have to emphasize that again, the fact that does not relate to what happens within Western societies. The fact that global inequality, not just between countries, but between people around the world, is now, and this seems to be becoming the consensus view amongst those who study this, is declining right now, has been declining since the turn of the millennium. And it is doing that for the first time since the Industrial Revolution. And that's a pretty remarkable thing. And we shouldn't just let that out of the whole picture. But when it comes to what happens within Western societies, yes, we've seen an increase in the Gini coefficient, the distribution of income between and of wealth within most Western societies since the 1980s. It's not a remarkable increase, but it has been increasing. But then we also have to mention that this was from a period, a moment in time when incomes and wealth had been, was remarkably and historically uniquely equally distributed for a few years. In the 1970s and 1980s, we had a very unique situation in the Western world. And this was something that was problematic, because it meant that it didn't pay much to get an education, didn't pay that much to take risks and work hard. And some of those changes have been for the benefit, not just for the richest, but for the whole societies, I think, when that has increased. Because we, and this is something that we often leave out of the discussion as well, what we do forget when we look at the distribution between different shares, between the tenths of the income distribution, now and in the 1970s, is that those tenths are not made up of the same individuals. They constantly change, because people enter into the lowest ladders of the income distribution as they leave education, and as they migrate to a new country, for example, and then they move upwards throughout their lives, throughout this income ladder. And then the poorest tenth now is then made up of new graduates and migrants. So saying that they now have much less in relation to the richest 10% or the average 10% is not the same as saying that those poor are becoming poorer all the time. We also need to look at this, the dynamics, the social mobility within this group. And I want to add one more thing about this inequality pattern as well, and that is, we often overemphasize what you have in your wallet, the particular dollars and cents, the euros you have in your wallet, and forget the purchasing power. And then obviously we will always see an increase in inequality as long as the Bill Gates and the Warren Buffetts of the world continue to make progress. They will probably leave the rest of us behind. But the fact that Bill Gates is 10 million times richer than I am doesn't mean that he's 10 million times better off than I am. If you look at the kind of goods and services that we buy, yes, he can afford a private jet, but that's but the major change over the last 50 years is that I can also board a plane and experience other places, other parts of the world. The middle classes, the many who used to be seen as the poorest of our society can afford those things. Yes, he can afford a more fancy computer or a cell phone, but the major change in the world is that the average person can afford that as well. And food and healthcare and education that we couldn't think of before. And so in terms of purchasing power, the kind of technologies, goods and services that we, that normal persons, and those who are considered losers in the present income distribution, they can afford goods and services that kings and queens couldn't dream of 100 years ago. This is the major difference. And when you look at that, rather than the number of dollars Bill Gates has in his bank account, then in many ways, the distribution of real goods and services is more equal than it has ever been before. And this is intimately tied to trade, to competition, to the fact that we can now buy cheaper goods and services from those who can produce this in the best and cheapest way, wherever they happen to be.
Your most recent book is called Progress. And by the way, it was recommended reading by Bill Gates. So apparently he has used his fortunes in a good way, since he has obviously bought it. And I think he also bought up many copies of Hans Rosling's book, Factfulness, in order to hand it out to students in the United States. But this is a fantastic book, and I recommend everyone to read it. And it basically walks through many of the developments that we've seen over both sort of a short and a long period of time that has led to radically improved life situations for a lot of people in the world. So a couple of things we're talking about here is that longevity has increased, child mortality has gone down, school enrollment is so much better around the world these days. Do you think, are these developments that are now slowing down, or that the growth in all these positive developments is going to be slower in the future because we're seeing trends in the world which aren't as supportive of taking a lot of developing countries into the global world economy anymore, that we rather have a trend that countries want to put up restrictions for some of these countries to participate in global competition?
Yes, I've always said that I'm an optimist in terms of what I think people do and are able to create when they are free to explore and experiment and exchange in science, technology, new business models, new innovations, new goods and services, and so on. Then people they accumulate more knowledge and ideas and insights and create more wealth every day. But I'm not necessarily an optimist in when it comes to politics, whether people will be free to do those things in the future. Progress is not automatic. It doesn't happen by itself. It's not just the natural order of things. It depends on whether we have openness to these new ideas, new innovations, new technologies, and to trade so that we can benefit from the brains and the hard work of people in other places. And this also means that we, if that trend is reversed, the trend that has resulted in the dismantling of walls, dictatorships, tariffs and quotas around the world, if that trend is reversed, then we will definitely see a slowing down of this progress. And that's something that I'm afraid of right now, when so many people are beginning to abandon the idea that globalization can bring forth progress in this extent. When we see a resurgence in tariff building, trade wars, and so on. Were that to happen, well, it simply means that more isolated people and businesses and markets will be able to use the brains of fewer people. They will have to rely more on what they can come up with locally, and more businesses will also exploit that situation by not moving into the kind of restructuring, the kind of innovation in both the business models and the goods and services that they produce, and that will slow down progress.
And a final question, Johan, and I know this is going to be a difficult one, but taking account of what you just said, how do you look towards different scenarios in the future? What do you think is most likely to happen? We have one argument which is pretty pessimistic, which is that no, everything is just going to get worse. Trump is here to stay, and all the other populists are here to stay, and they are going to reduce economic openness. They're going to reduce the pace of modernization in societies. We're going to have more confrontation between Europe and perhaps America on the same side, China on the other side, perhaps more trade confrontation between the EU and the United States as well. On the other hand, you can also make the argument that the policies that are being pursued right now, I mean, they are hardly leading to success, right? It's not that Trump's tariffs or the type of protectionism that we've been seeing evolving in Europe over the past years, that it's leading to great results. On the contrary, they tend to lead to economic backwardness, technological backwardness, or that there is a greater problems of attracting investors, attracting innovators, attracting entrepreneurs that want to do great things in your part of the world. So how would you sort of contrast the way up these two scenarios against each other? Are you a pessimist or an optimist?
At the risk of sounding like optimism is just a personality trait, I would say that I'm more optimistic than many people that I speak to, even when it comes to this. And the simple reason is is what you're saying, that these policies, these populist policies so far, doesn't seem like a great success. And that's the thing. It's not like I found it very interesting when Trump was elected in the United States, that many political leaders around the world were a bit hesitant, not to say downright hostile. But he was welcomed by a particular brand of populists in Latin America. The first reaction from Argentinian Peronists, for example, was to say that, look, Donald Trump is a Peronist. He's doing exactly what we tried to do in Argentina for a long time, with tariffs, with industrial policy, and picking winners, and a more authoritarian leadership. And even groups within the Venezuelan ruling party then said that this is great. America is moving away from the imperialist globalization free trade policies and approaching our policies over here. And the interesting thing is obviously that the Peronism of the Kirchners, for example, the policies of Chavismo in Venezuela and so on, were defeated by themselves, by implementing their ideas and losing out badly, dramatically, big time. And this is often the pattern when it comes to populists. It's incredibly easy to point out all the problems with the particular policies that goes on around the world, including free trade and the rule of law and open markets. That's incredibly easy, and it's so tempting to say that everything could be different and much better. And it seems like it's also possible to get a majority or almost a majority for positions like that. But it's incredibly difficult to deliver on those policies. So I think that the one of the major problems in the future for these nativist populists is that when they're forced to deliver, they disappoint and people move on to something else, hopefully to something better. But that obviously remains to be seen. But the what it means is that we shouldn't just think that because something has started, it will continue in that way. What it will be replaced with, well, that depends on the work that you do and I do and the listeners of this podcast do, because the future is in our hands. It's all dependent on whether we can explain the benefits of an open world again and create a convincing message. In that case, I think there are reasons to be hopeful about the future.
Johan, it's been great talking to you. Thanks so much for joining the podcast.
It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
And thanks also to all of you who have listened. Bye-bye.